Welcome back. And to those who are just joining us, welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We are now ready to begin our second argument for this morning. That case is State versus Jacob Jordan Johnson, case number A20-1109. And just a few words of wisdom for the attorneys before you begin to present your arguments. Please introduce yourself and the party you're representing for our record. Be mindful of the time limitations. We have a camera right on the screen for you that will count down your times. The appellant will have 15 minutes, respondent will have 15 minutes, and then appellant will have the opportunity for a 5-minute rebuttal. And then finally, this argument, which is being held over the Zoom platform, is being recorded and will be available to the public on our website shortly. With that, I will turn things over to the attorneys. We will begin with counsel for the appellant. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Benjamin Butler. I represent the appellant, Jacob Johnson. This court must reverse Mr. Johnson's conviction because he did not intentionally aid Jamie McNeary's commission of third-degree murder, and because the district court committed reversible error by denying Mr. Johnson's requested jury instruction. I'd like to start with the sufficiency issue. This case is about aiding and abetting liability under 60905. Mr. Johnson is not guilty of third-degree murder as a principal because he did not sell any drugs to the decedent, Jacob Borman. That doesn't end the inquiry, obviously. A person can be liable for, quote, a crime committed by another in two different ways. The, quote, crime committed by another at issue here is Jamie McNeary's commission of third-degree murder. So we need to look to subdivisions 1 and 2 of 60905 to determine whether Mr. Johnson is liable. Under subdivision 1, a person can be liable for a crime committed by another if the person intentionally aids that the commission of that crime. Mr. Johnson is not liable under subdivision 1 because he did not intentionally aid the commission of third degree murder. He did not intend for anybody to die. No one intended for anyone to die. I agree with that.
But doesn't that statute, there's no intent as a part of that statute. Isn't that right, Mr. Butler?
There's no intent requirement, Your Honor, for third degree murder. But there is a specific intent requirement for aiding and abetting all crimes, including third degree murder under subdivision 1 of 60905. And so what that means is that Mr. McNeary has no defense no intent defense to the charge against him. And the reason for that is because he's the principal. He actually sold drugs to Mr. Borman, and those drugs proximately caused Mr. Borman's death. He has no defense that it was an accident or that he didn't intend to cause death. But Mr. Johnson did not sell drugs to anybody. The state is trying to make Mr. Johnson liable for Mr. McNeary's crime. And when the state tries to do that, the legislature has put in additional requirements, which makes sense because Mr. Johnson did not commit a crime himself. You're trying to make him liable for someone else's crime. And one of the additional requirements under subdivision 1 is that the defendant has to intend to aid the commission of the charged offense. The charged offense in this case being third degree murder. That is the crime that's at issue in subdivision 1. Now, and that didn't happen here. There's no question that didn't happen here. Now, a person can, of course, be liable for aiding and abetting an unintentional or an unintended crime. That liability has to come from section 60905, subdivision 2. Subdivision 2 says that a defendant is guilty of any other crime committed in pursuance of, quote, the intended crime, if that other crime is reasonably foreseeable to the defendant and was committed in furtherance of the intended crime. The intended crime here for Mr. Johnson was a drug sale. I think it amounts to a third degree drug sale. That was all he wanted to do, was to help Mr. Borman acquire a personal use amount of heroin. That's either a third or fourth degree controlled substance crime sale. That's the intended crime. So the question is, was third degree murder committed in furtherance of that drug sale? And was it reasonably foreseeable as a probable consequence of committing that drug sale? And the state has to prove both in order to make Mr. Johnson liable.
Mr. Butler, the foreseeability argument aside, because I think that's actually a more challenging argument for you, is it strictly a timing thing? Does one have to come before the other, or can it mean something else?
No, Your Honor, it's not strictly a timing thing. The Supreme Court has murder cases, first degree murder cases involving robberies, including the case that's cited in our brief, where the robbery happens first, and then the robber, you know, having completed the robbery, turns around and shoots and kills the victim. So as a pure matter of timing, the robbery happened first and then the murder. But the murder in that situation would be committed to further the robbery, because it would stop the victim from getting up and chasing after the robber, or identifying the robber in a police lineup or something like that. That's what the Supreme Court has told us. That's not the case here. Murder in this case, meaning the death of Mr. Borman, that's the quote unquote murder. We're calling it murder, though the legislature calls it murder, but really what it means is the death of Mr. Borman from the drugs allegedly sold by Mr. McNeary. That doesn't further the drug sale. Not only is the drug sale over, so as a matter of timing, it doesn't work, but there's nothing about the death of Mr. Borman that completes the drug sale, that insulates the drug sale from further consequences or anything like that. The exact opposite is true. Mr. McNeary would have no incentive to have Mr. Borman die. Mr. Borman's a customer. He has no, why would he want one of his customers to die? Mr. Johnson does not.
Mr. Butler, could the possibility of death that may naturally come with a drug sale be in pursuance of the drug sale?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't, because what the statute says, if you go back to the language of 6905 subdivision 2, it says a person liable under subdivision 1, meaning you've intended to aid some crime, is also liable for any other crime, and this is the language, committed in pursuance of the intended crime. So crime B, which in this case is the charged offense, murder 3, has to be committed in pursuance of crime A, the intended crime, which is a drug sale. That works in a lot of aiding and abetting situations, right? It works in the bank robber situation, where the guy goes in to rob a bank. Nobody intends for anyone to die, but during the course of the bank robbery, the bank robber shoots and kills somebody. Okay, that murder, that homicide, is committed in furtherance of the bank robbery, because the point is to help the bank robbery finish, or at least to help the bank robber not get caught. But it's not true here with these crimes, because there's nothing about the death of Mr. Borman several hours after the drug transaction is over and done with that furthers that particular drug transaction. That particular drug transaction is done. And again,
in this case, was the jury instructed on aiding and abetting liability on accomplice liability with respect to both subdivisions 1 and 2?
Yes, Your Honor, they were.
Okay. I had a question going back to subdivision 1, if Judge Gaetis wants to pursue subdivision 2, I will wait. But.
And I was just going to state he was convicted. You're arguing the conviction under subdivision 1, aren't you?
No, I'm arguing neither. The jury was instructed on both subdivisions,
guilty under subdivision 1.
I'm not sure we can say that specifically, Your Honor. If that's how you read the record, that's fair. But I don't believe there's a special interrogatory or anything like that. I think he's just found guilty.
I apologize to Judge Johnson. Now I don't recall what triggered me to ask my question. If you could.
Well, I think just to clarify, I think Judge Warkey, you might be referring to the third degree murder statute subdivision 2, and Judge Johnson was referring to accomplice liability in that statute.
Yes.
Yes.
And so I think now we're all on the same page.
Yes.
Judge Johnson, I don't have any questions, go ahead. Feel free to ask your question about subdivision one of whichever statute you were planning to inquire about.
Thank you. I mean, it seems to me that the actus reus, perhaps, that McNeary engaged in is the selling or giving away, bartering, delivering, et cetera. And it seems to me a fairly straightforward matter that under subdivision one, if Johnson intentionally aided, advised, hired, counseled, conspired with McNeary to sell or give away, to give the drugs to the victim, then it seems like he has committed the offense pursuant to subdivision one of the accomplice statute. It seems relatively straightforward to me. Why is that not, even though the underlying crime, third degree murder, felony murder by giving drugs, does not require intent. Aiding and abetting requires intent, but if he intends to help McNeary distribute the drugs, and then the distribution of the drugs is what caused the death, that seems to connect rather easily for me. So I don't understand. What am I missing there, Mr. Powell?
Sure. I think, Judge, what you're missing, for lack of a better word, is that the statute doesn't say actus reus. So I think you're right about that is, if we're doing criminal law theory and dividing acts, one of the actus reuses of third degree murder is a drug sale, obviously. But what the aiding and abetting statute says is a person is criminally liable for, quote, a crime committed by another. So the state has to prove, if he intentionally aids, blah, 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 the other, quote, to commit the crime in total, not just part of the crime, like the actus reus, but the crime in total.
Isn't it? So, I mean, are you saying the evidence is insufficient that McNeary committed a crime?
No. McNeary did commit a crime. I'm saying the evidence is insufficient to show that Mr. Johnson intended to aid the crime McNeary committed.
But if he intended to aid McNeary's sale of the drugs to Borman, isn't that sufficient?
No, it's not, Your Honor, because McNeary's sale of the drugs to Borman, if we stop right there, that's not the crime at issue. That's a drug sale. So if Mr. Johnson, if the state had charged Mr. Johnson with only count one, aiding and abetting third degree heroin sale, then I would agree with you that Mr. Johnson would be liable under subdivision one, because Mr. McNeary committed a third degree heroin sale and Mr. Johnson intended to aid him in committing that crime. A crime committed by another is third degree heroin sale, and the crime at the end of the sentence of 05 is third degree heroin sale.
But isn't it basically true that because of 0.195B, the selling of drugs, which is a crime in itself under chapter 152, I think, becomes felony murder if the person dies, basically. Yeah. I mean if the consequence of selling the drugs is the person's death, and if there's causation, then the person who sold the drugs is guilty of murder, and I guess whether they intended the death or not. So I still don't see why this is so difficult for us to connect these dots.
Sure. I think, Your Honor, you're thinking about the death as like an enhancement of a drug sale. Like we have a drug sale, and then if the drug sale causes death, the penalty is enhanced or something like that. That's not the way the legislature wrote these statutes. So first of all, you skipped, when you described the statute accurately, 195 per NB, you said causation, proximate causation, and cause death. That's a really big thing. I mean, that's how most of these cases are litigated, is on causation. So it's not as simple as did you sell the drugs and did the person die? The crime of third degree murder is its own, this form of third degree murder is its own crime. And it has elements. And so when the aiding and abetting statute says you have to intend to help the person commit the crime, that means all of the crime. I don't know any other way to read the phrase the crime to just mean part of the crime. You have to intend to help all the crime. And I think that in most cases, this isn't a problem. Right. In most of these drug sale cases, for example, there's no aiding and abetting liability at all. The drug seller sells drugs to the decedent. The decedent uses the drugs and dies. That's it. We don't need to get into foreseeability. We don't need to get into in pursuance of, because the drug seller is guilty very simply under 195. In most aiding and abetting cases, this is all very simple. Because a person, if I go, you know, we're going to go out and commit a robbery, I know we're going to go out and commit a robbery. So no problem under subdivision one. If during the robbery you kill somebody, I'm stuck under subdivision two because it was reasonably foreseeable. This is a really weird case. I have never seen a third degree murder charged as aiding and abetting with this particular set of facts without the person being more involved in the drug distribution. So for example, in the Vasquez case, which comes up a lot in respondent's brief, the alleged accomplice there isn't just a mere link in the chain. He takes the original seller, which is Mr. Vasquez, gives the drugs to Mr. Chapman, I believe his name is. Mr. Chapman cooks the drugs, the heroin, and then hands them to the decedent. Those actions by Mr. Chapman make him a principal. He's guilty of third degree murder as a principal because cooking the drugs and handing them to the decedent is a sale. Mr. Johnson doesn't do any of that. And so I guess my point is this court can reverse Mr. Johnson's conviction on this theory without some fear that you're going to upset every third degree drug murder that gets charged in the state of Minnesota, because most of them are not like this.
Thank you for your argument, Mr. Butler. You'll have the opportunity for rebuttal. And next, we will hear from counsel for respondent, state of Minnesota.
And please, the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Peter Magnuson. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent the respondent, state of Minnesota. With respect to this first issue, appellant argues that he's not liable under subdivision one of the accomplice liability statute because the defendant didn't intend that Borman would die. That argument fails for two reasons. First, it fails to acknowledge this court's holding in Vasquez. As this court's questions make clear, if you're a cog in the sale of the drugs, then under Vasquez, you are an accomplice for purposes of the third degree murder controlled substance statute. The evidence makes clear that appellant was an indispensable cog. Mr. Borman, the victim in this case, did not know Mr. McNeary, the drug seller. Appellant was the person that put those two in contact with each other and asked that Borman come over and pick him up and brought him over to where the drug sale took place. So it's clear that he was a cog in this sale, and under Vasquez, which is the controlling case here, I believe, it's clear that he's an accomplice to the third degree murder.
So are you saying, Mr. Magnuson, that the only inquiry we have to make is whether an individual is a cog in a drug sale? I mean, it seems like there's a huge variability there. I mean, even comparing this case to what happened in the Vasquez case, there's a very different conduct involved.
Well, I should restate that the language used in Vasquez is link in the chain of distribution. So was appellant a link in the chain of distribution? Without question, he was a link in the chain of distribution, because but for, without his participation, Borman doesn't buy these drugs from McNeary and never ingests the fentanyl-laced drugs. So he is a link in the chain of distribution. Therefore, under Vasquez, he becomes an accomplice. This brings up my second point, that this argument that McNeary didn't have to have any intent, because intent isn't a requirement under 609.195, but intent is a requirement under 609.05, it raises a situation where appellant is arguing that the state has different burdens of proof with respect to intent when we're talking about a principal and an accomplice under 609.195 subdivision B. He cites to no precedent, no authority for that proposition, and I'm unaware of anyone that would somehow place the state having a higher burden proof with respect to intent for an accomplice as opposed to the principal. It's clear. I think we can all assume that Mr. McNeary did not intend that Mr. Borman would die from the drugs that he sold. Nonetheless, he ran that risk when he sold those drugs. And yes, he maybe intended to commit a third degree drug sale, but once Mr. Borman died, then third degree controlled substance murder comes into play. And as it specifically says, whoever without intent to cause death. So had there been evidence that Mr. McNeary intended to cause his death, well, then this would have been charged out differently. But as the Supreme Court said in Carithers, this court said in Schnagel, the third degree controlled substance murder statute is aimed at the commercial distribution of drugs, which results in someone's death. That's exactly what happened here. So under subdivision one of 609.05, appellant was clearly guilty as an accomplice. With respect to the second issue that wasn't touched on by appellant, but I don't think it's a plain error for his argument on appeal, because below the appellant relied on the Carithers decision, and as the district court properly held, the Carithers decision doesn't apply. This court's decision in Schnagel makes that clear. The argument that he makes on appeal relying on Swinnington was not raised below, so the plain error standard applies, and Swinnington is an apposite, so I don't think it can form the basis for a finding by this court that the district court plainly erred when it failed to sua sponte give an instruction based on that analysis.
Mr. Magnuson, am I correct in understanding that in the district court, the appellant did propose a jury instruction that would additional language that the defendant appellant wanted inserted, and that's the same language that, I mean, the argument, I think, am I correct that the defendant did that below?
Yes, the defendant argued that under Carithers, he was entitled to a joint acquisition jury instruction. The district court said, no, Carithers has, the only application it has is when the...
My question is that I question whether we should focus on the reasons for which defendant proposed the jury instruction. It seems to me if the defendant had specific proposed text, offered it to the district court, refused to give it, and on appeal, appellant says not giving that instruction is error. That seems to me to be adequate preservation, without the need for parsing the particular argument made there compared to the argument made on appeal. I don't know, is there case law that is on your side on that particular procedural issue?
Well, I'm not arguing that it wasn't preserved. It was preserved. My argument is what standard of review applies to the arguments on appeal. It's an abuse of discretion standard under the Carithers argument, but since the argument was not made under Swinnington below, I don't think the district court can be faulted under the abuse of discretion standard for ruling against appellant on an argument that was not advanced. So I think he can make the argument under State v. Swinnington. It's just what standard of review does this court apply? And I think that standard of review is plain error. So there can't be a plain error, I don't think, when Swinnington is factually inapposite. So it wouldn't be plainly error for the district court to have not independently ruled in appellant's favor based on Swinnington. That's my argument. But at the end of the day, I think appellant spent four pages arguing essentially the joint acquisition theory to the jury, arguing that there was evidence in the record that based on appellant's statement that he used some of the drugs, so he was a co-user as opposed to a link in the chain of distribution. But obviously the district or the jury rejected that argument when it found appellant guilty. I don't have any other arguments. If the court has some questions, I'd be happy to address them. Otherwise, I'll rest my time.
I just took a look at Vasquez during your argument. The issue there had to do with a jury instruction and whether a certain person was an accomplice so as to justify the, but it's not a sufficiency of the evidence case. Does it still preclude appellant's first argument in this appeal?
Yes, an accomplice is an accomplice. Whether we're talking about the jury instruction or the sufficiency of the evidence. So I think it's on point, but even if it's not directly on point, its analysis is certainly persuasive. And I don't see that that a court could come to a different conclusion that appellant did not intend to aid this sale. He directly aided the sale of the drugs, and that's the issue here, because the sale of that drugs, unfortunately, approximately caused Mr. Borman's death.
Would you agree, though, Mr. Magnuson, that just based on the factual circumstances of Chapman, where the alleged accomplice actually injected the victim or prepared the injection for the victim, that this case is sort of stretching the analysis given the much more limited role that was alleged here?
I would disagree. I don't see this as a stretch at all. Again, Mr. Borman does not buy drugs from Mr. McNeary without the involvement of appellant. It's as simple as that.
So your argument is essentially if you help someone with a drug hookup, you are responsible as an accomplice for any death that may occur, unintentional death that may occur.
Yes, as with McNeary, McNeary probably did not intend that Mr. Borman would die. Had there been evidence that he had that intent, I'm sure this would have been charged differently. But again, in Carruthers and Schnagel, this court has talked about the purposes of the third degree controlled substance murder is to penalize the commercial distribution of drugs, which results in somebody's death. That's what occurred here. And the guilty verdict should be affirmed.
Any other questions? I see none. So thank you for your argument, Mr. Magnuson.
Thank you.
And Mr. Butler, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. I want to start with Judge Gaetis's last question, to respondent, which was, if you help someone with a drug hookup, are you guilty if that person ends up dying? And Mr. Magnuson, quite reasonably and consistent with his position, said yes. That's exactly this case. And Your Honors, if that seems strange to you, I would suggest it's because that's not true. That is not what the law says. Mr. Magnuson said that our position is that the state has different intent burdens for principals and for aiders and abettors. They absolutely have different intent burdens for principals and for aiders and abettors. And the reason for that is not only that's what the statutes say, 60905 says intentionally, and 609195 says without intent. So right away, that is a difference. And that makes sense because the aider and abettor, and remember, get back to basics, has not actually committed a crime, any crime. Mr. Johnson didn't sell anyone any drugs. Mr. Johnson didn't murder anyone. Mr. Johnson aided someone else's actions. And so when the state is trying to bring in, I'll use the word innocent, an innocent person's actions and stick that person with liability for someone else's crime, the legislature says, yes, we are going to make you prove that the person intended to aid that particular crime. Not just part of it, not just the actus reus, but the crime. That's subdivision one. And there is nothing remarkable or different or new about that. That is what aiding and abetting liability is.
It just seems, I guess, so how would, I mean, are there any facts, can you think of any hypothetical under your view of the law where a person could aid and abet this crime by intending the entire crime?
I think it's probably, under subdivision one, I think it's yes. probably tough. I think it's tough to show intent to aid an unintentional crime, right? Those two things don't go together. They're sort of inherently contradictory. Under subdivision two, though, for most aiding and abetting cases and most unintentional crimes, the liability is under subdivision two. So take the bank robbery example. I'm the getaway driver. The gunman goes into the bank and he accidentally kills someone. Doesn't mean to. So it's not an intentional murder, right? But the gun goes off or whatever. That is an unintentional felony murder because it's an unintended death committed during the course of a robbery. Okay. As the getaway driver, I am guilty. I am not guilty under subdivision one. I didn't intend for anyone to die. I didn't intend, and I certainly didn't intend to aid an unintentional murder. That doesn't make sense. I am guilty though under subdivision two, because unintentional felony murder was committed during the course of the bank robbery and was reasonably foreseeable as a probable consequence of the bank robbery, so even unintentional felony murder.
Can I once again bring you back to subdivision one, which I think sure. is where which I think is the most direct line from the beginning to the end of the analysis. It seems, but I mean, the conduct for which McNeary was convicted or could have been convicted was the selling of the drugs. And he was not required to intend Borman's death, but I'm still having a hard time understanding why a person charged with aiding and abetting under subdivision one must intend more than to aid the sale of the drugs. Must intend the death if the principal can be guilty without intending the death. I don't understand why the aider and abetter cannot be found guilty without intending the death.
Because the aiding and abetting statute, Your Honor, uses the word crime. The crime of third degree murder has many elements. One is the actus reus that you described, which is selling the drugs. Another is proximate causation, and another is death. So to intend to aid the crime, the word the crime encompasses all of the elements of the crime, not just some of them. And this idea that we can equate selling the drugs with third degree murder, I think is simply, and that does seem to be the state's argument, I think it's simply false. It minimizes third degree murder. Third degree murder isn't just selling drugs. If Mr. Johnson was charged with aiding and abetting a drug sale, he'd be guilty under subdivision one. He could conceivably be guilty under subdivision two of some other crime, but only if those two qualifications of subdivision two are met. And they were not in this case because the murder didn't further the drug sale, and it wasn't reasonably foreseeable.
So I feel like we're talking, and I'm probably repeating myself, I won't do it again, but I feel like we're talking about some fundamental concepts. I mean, are there other fundamental Supreme Court opinions that you're relying on which are not directly cited because they're more, you know, foundational in your argument? I'm just having a hard time understanding.
Yeah, I think we are talking about fundamental concepts. I agree with you. I think for subdivision two purposes, the first degree murder case that's cited in our brief is actually really clear and a really nice roadmap of how to walk through subdivision two liability. So I'd point you back to that. As far as subdivision one goes, I would just come back to the Charlton case, which is cited in our brief, which says that aiding and abetting is a specific intent theory of liability. Not just intentional, because lots of things are intentional in one way or another, but specific intent. And I'm sorry, Judge Gaitis, I didn't ask for permission to answer Judge Johnson's question. May I have another 30 seconds?
That was implicit.
Thank you.
You may continue your answer and then wrap up. Thanks.
Thank you. So Charlton says aiding and abetting is a specific intent theory of liability. Specific intent means intent to cause a particular result. And that's from State versus Fleck, which is not cited in our brief, but I think this court is well aware of the Fleck opinion, to cause a particular result. That's what specific intent means. And so in this context, to cause a particular result means to intend to commit the full crime, which includes Mr. Borman's death. Now, that doesn't make any sense. Of course he doesn't intend that. Nobody intends for Mr. Borman to die. I agree with that. And I think the state agrees with that. That doesn't clear him of liability, Mr. Johnson. It only moves us to subdivision two. And then we have to go through the subdivision two steps. And I think the state flunks the subdivision two steps as well. And for that reason, the court should reverse Mr. Johnson's conviction.
I just have one more question, actually. Just so I understand, are you arguing essentially that given the 60905 standard, it is impossible for anyone to aid and abet this offense?
Third degree murder, this particular offense, I think it's tough. I'm not sure I can come up with a theory under where it would be possible, but I would say that if it is possible, it's something a lot closer to what happened in Vasquez. Because what happened in Vasquez is the person, takes the drugs from the seller, cooks them, gives them to the decedent. It's really, I think a jury could say, look, I think when you do that, when you give the cooked heroin to the decedent and I believe inject her personally, or at least help her inject herself, that's committed. That's still during the course of the drug sale, because the drug sale is continuing from person A to person B, Mr. Chapman, to person C, the decedent. So that sale is during the course of the drug sale, and it's certainly reasonably foreseeable to you that this person's going to die. That's not the case here. Number one, Mr. Johnson, I get the idea that he's a link in the chain under this but-for theory. But if we're going to talk about link in the chain went directly from Mr. McNeary to Mr. Borman. Mr. Johnson never touched those drugs. So that's the chain. It wasn't committed during the course of, and it certainly wasn't reasonably foreseeable, because it wasn't reasonably foreseeable that Mr. McNeary was going to spike his tiny amount of heroin with fentanyl.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both for your arguments today. The matter is now submitted to this court, and we will issue our decision within the statutory timeframe. This ends our oral calendar for today as well. The court will now adjourn to consider its non-oral cases. Thank you all.